And next on our agenda is an update on the task force on the Oregon State Fair. With us, Senator Courtney and Representative Winters. Welcome, and thanks for being here. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Chair Wilson, and we're glad that you invited us here. And we always strive to be on time, as you understand, the two legislators from Salem are very punctual. One comes at 1 and the other one gets here at 1:15. Just to give you some overview on where we have been and what where we currently are, and you have before you a list of the task force membership, and I won't repeat that. You can review it at your leisure. Our responsibility was set forth under Budget Note Senate Bill 515, which appointed the task force to develop the strategic plan for the State Fair and Expo Center. And our date to submit our recommendations to the Emergency Board is June 22nd and the 2001 legislature. We passed during the last session, as you will recall, the authorization to expend $10 million in lottery bonds and for capital construction, some improvement at the State Fair. To date, we issued, I think, $2 million with $8.2 million that's still remaining. The feasibility study was also a part of the plan. That study was a $60,000 study that was funded by the state, the county, and the city so that we had tri-partnership in looking at the future of the state plan and what we should and should not be doing. In addition to that study, we have the modernization plan, the which is also underway, and that study cost $99,000. I received some information this morning that it had a figure of somewhere about 400 and some thousand, and that was corrected. That, no, it was a $99,000 project. To date, we met in November, and we met again in February, and we have had some preliminary review of the feasibility study and its findings, and I understand that today they are meeting with the Oregon Fair Commission with their report, and following that meeting, we should be getting their completed report from the feasibility study itself. And our target date for the Fair Commission to present its report to us is April 6th to present us with their findings. And you can jump in at any time if you want. And to date, you know, we expect, and some of the things that the finding will show is some of the things that we already knew the last session, the discussion about the deterioration of the facilities, the cost of operating the fair, whether or not the fair can operate as a private entity without having support from state general funds. The other issue is the horse racing revenues and whether or not we should continue horse racing at the state fair, whether there is the investment there in order to cover its cost. Those are some of the items that are being reviewed and being looked at. In addition to that, the consultants were asked to look at multiple use of land, to look at it in terms of could we have the fair, including the sports center, to begin thinking outside the box? Could we have some partnerships that didn't exist currently? So their charge is to go beyond just to look at the Oregon State Fair. In addition, in looking at the state fair, to look at such issues as whether rotating the fair around the state is workable, whether there should be a regional fair. Some of the questions that we raised during session are the questions that they will be that they're attempting to address for us.
It falls to Representative Chair Wilson, members of the House General Government Committee. It falls to Representative Winters and myself to co-chair this task force. We which has as one of its members, Representative Hansen, who's here today, as well as Senator Gene Durfler and Senator Duncan and Representative Bachman. It also has, as you notice, a Marion County Commissioner and two members of the Salem City Council, as well as the head of the Chamber of Commerce. That the design of this task force, while somewhat limited geographically, is well done in terms of state and local government, because these county fairs are a major part of Representative Winters and Representative Hansen and Senator Courtney's concern. I can assure you that, because if this fair is perceived as a Salem fair, then the state legislature, rightfully so, would say, Salem, it's your responsibility. It's in your backyard. This state fair must be perceived and must, in fact, be something that belongs to the state of Oregon. And it wasn't until I became involved in this, almost embarrassingly so, I admit to you, Mr. Chair and members of general government, that I did not realize the connection between the county fairs and this particular facility. And we approach it that way. Now, she started out, the representative was saying, we're from Salem, the two of us, but just yesterday we met with staff, and last week we met by ourselves. We constantly talk about how can we get individuals to perceive the work that we're doing on this task force, and I think Representative Hansen, Representative Chair Wilson would agree to this, to understand that while we're from Salem, we're working our tails off to reach out and make sure there are nexus with all parts of this state. And I'm not just blowing smoke, and I'm not just trying to play games with you. There is a residence hall out there that I didn't even know about. It potentially can house 300 young men and women. It is dysfunctional. It cannot be used today. And that is a total tragedy, because if that be turned into a hostel type of thing. That's one of the recommendations. Really updated so boys and girls could come and live there for different events involving animals from across the state. It would be remarkable what we could do there. But that's just an example of what I'm just trying to tell you. We can get into the other facilities in terms of business types of events, but when you talk about animals and children, something which I know is near and dear to everybody who now faces me, as well as the good representative, the potential out there is unlimited. We, the co-chairs, have a very difficult responsibility because we know we're going to have to come up with what we call a co-chair's recommendation. We plan to do that, Representative Hansen. I speak to Mr. Chair, to Representative Hansen, because he's on the committee as well. There used to be a co-chair's budget. That was a famous phrase used in this building. Well, we plan to have a co-chair's recommendation on this state fair that will be comprehensive regarding the organization of the state fair. I hope you don't push me too hard on that. Regarding certain activities that are going on out there, the financing of this. And I think that when we get through, while at least some of this may be difficult stuff that we're going to have to confront, we hope that by doing that, we are able to bring this fair closer to all of Oregon, to you and your respective districts, as well as to those many districts that are out there that, you know, that we all basically, maybe not directly but indirectly, I think represents as sworn officers of the Oregon legislature. I do want to make that philosophical statement, because I think I am as sensitive as anybody in this room about this fact that this fair has got to work harder. This facility has got to work harder to connect up with the rest of Oregon, or it's a goner. And it's in trouble now. It is really in trouble now. And most of it's probably its own responsibility, its own fault. Did you tell them about the e-board thing, or is that before then, or you want to?
No. Well, one of them, when Senator Courtney mentioned there are some concerns now, there was a plan to go to the e-board because of a projected shortfall. And I asked, and with Senator Courtney and I, the staff, to go back and to look internally to see how much can be done internally within their existing budget before requesting any additional dollars in order to put on the fair that's coming up in 2000. And they estimated the shortfall originally at about $683,000. And our staff and their staff, and everybody's working together to look at ways that they can reshuffle things around and program, and they will be coming back to us with their plans and not hopefully have to go and ask for additional dollars up from the emergency board. If it is, it would not be as great as what they originally had thought that it would be. And that's very positive because everybody is trying, you know, their best to do everything possible to make sure that we have, one, the fair this year, and two, that we're as efficient and as economical as possible while we look at what we need to do for the future with the state fair.
Any questions? Representative Hansen.
If I could just briefly add to some of the comments that Senator Courtney's made. One of the real compelling issues that I think came forth or in our first meeting, and I unfortunately, because of some medical problems, I had to miss the last one, but the state fair is one of the few things where all Oregonians actually come together. Maybe the Civil War game might be another one, but that just, you know, that's a little iffier. But it draws people from all sections of Oregon, from the metropolitan area, from the very rural areas, and this is such a diverse state, there aren't too many events like that that really bring us all together. And it's not just a Salem thing, it's very definitely a state thing that has linkages to every county in the state, and it's very important for it to thrive and move forward. There is, and I think with this task force, the local representation, though, from Marion County and from the city of Salem is incredibly valuable, too, because they're the neighbors of the fair, and for it to thrive, it has to thrive in its own local environment. But I think we've got a good balance of a very strong state perspective as well as really good local input. So I think we'll do fine.
I might also offer, you know, we've learned a lot in this task force. One of the things that we've learned just recently talking about the county fairs and how that county fairs play a part into feeding into the state fair, and we were looking at the makeup of the commission, and one idea thought that we had that we really don't have provision to assure that there is representation from those county fairs, and we were thinking that probably we may want to look at possible legislation to assure that there is that county piece there. They're a major player in what occurs at the state level. And Senator Courtney and I were thinking that they really should be a major player when it comes to making some of the decisions on the commission. We may want to give some thought to how we can really make that happen in the next legislative session.
Thank you. Representative Loken.
Thank you, Chair. When you say the tie between the counties, is there a tie now? Is there any exchange in coordinating and planning either for the state or the state fair with the county fairs? Or
a number of the state fairs, they do meet and they do coordinate. They do talk together and they attempt to work together. Yes, that informal network is taking place. It was some of our thoughts that the commission itself does not specify that you had to have someone representing the counties, for example, on the commission. That may be something that we need to make the coordination even tighter.
It was explained to me this way. As you know, just last week, there was at the Coliseum, we held the 4A boys basketball tournament. And I think at the same time in Corvallis, we were holding the 3A boys and girls. Over in Baker, they held the 1A, and in Pendleton, they held the 2A. What I'm saying to you is the Marion County Fair, which I recently went to a dinner in which they handed out awards for their volunteers, very nice little function. This is the moment for many kids who do well at the county fairs. I hope now the chair is going to help me with this, because I think this particular reason I'm saying this, because he really is connected well with his county fairs. This is where you go for that moment where you do well at that level. Not that other kids who don't necessarily win prizes don't bring their animals or their whatever, but to go, then they go to the state fair. And so my point is, Representative Loken, is there is planning to that extent. I am convinced that probably there isn't enough planning. There isn't enough input from these county fairs, and that is why right now I believe, if I'm not wrong, Janet Atkins, who's doing a remarkable job chairing our task force, there are five members on the commission that oversees the fair. Each one is chosen from each one of the five congressional districts. Rather than us subtract or dilute that, we were going to add to that had to come from county fairs or let the county fairs decide. So you'd have a seven-member commission. We don't think that would be too large, but we would guarantee that. That's the legislation that we were just ourselves, with all due respect to Representative Hansen, I didn't mean to catch him by surprise. We ourselves were just sort of thinking about that to make sure this kind of input, Representative Loken, that your question basically asked about was more absolute, was more continuous, and was more comprehensive.
Other questions? I want to ask a question here about the facility itself. Is there a prototype facility out there that you're looking to model what you'd like this fairgrounds to be like ultimately? Is there a facility out there somewhere? Does some state have a facility like this, a fairgrounds that is somewhat more self-sustaining than ours is? Have you looked at anything like that?
I don't know if you have copies. Of the feasibility study where they, I'm sort of speaking out of, I just saw something here that, I don't want to mislead you. They reviewed in that the many different state fairs, Chair Wilson. You take the Minnesota State Fair, which is a quasi-state agency, but it has no public subsidy of any kind. And it's considered fairly successful. They rave about the fact that it has it's been pretty successful. But then you go over to... I'm trying to think. I want to get one here that and the answer is no, but I'm trying to think. Where's Montana? It receives an annual funding from the state of approximately $400,000. So you go from Montana State Fair to the Minnesota State Fair, which is, while it's quasi-state agency, it operating with no public subsidy of any kind and consists of delegates from the state's county fairs and various agribusiness groups. What we're trying to do now is, and there's some privatization that goes on some of these fairgrounds. You know what I mean? They allow, here in Salem, we have this Wallace Marine Softball Complex, which they say is one of the best on the West Coast. The city put it together, et cetera. But the actual baseball or softball complex is done through a private vendor overview by the city government. Where we're going to get challenged, I believe, in our recommendations is, and I think we're going to end up with a hybrid. I don't think we're going to go as far as Minnesota, and I don't think we're going to go all the way to Montana, where they had necessarily. We're going to end up in the middle somewhere, I think. Now, again, I got to be careful here, where we'll look at all the functions and the programs out there to decide privatization of who's in charge. And so I don't think we have a prototype now, and to the best of my knowledge, I don't think one is being recommended. And the only reason I'm looking back at Janet is in terms of all the documentation. And could I ask the folks, Dan, could you?
The consultant for the master plan and the feasibility study, I'm Janet Atkins, a committee staff for the task force, have looked at all state fairs. They selected a number in the report to highlight in terms of their operating costs and their facilities, and they've looked at all of them and have national experience. I think the task force and the commission will have the benefit of that information, and some of it's in table format. But again, for the population area around Salem and including Portland, we have a pretty good penetration rate in terms of market for what we do have, because some of the other ones that make a lot of money are in a higher population area. But again, they're using that to benefit what they're doing, and the master planning consultants have experience nationwide. Okay. So they're looking at pieces that may work here.
Thank you. When it comes to the privatization issue, it seems to me that last session, we dealt with some issue regarding private funding of facilities and buildings on the grounds. It seems to me we did, but I don't know what happened to that.
We did the sponsorships.
Okay.
And we did pass the enabling legislation to allow the fair to more aggressively go after sponsorship.
Yeah, I know there was some concern that it would turn into the Fujifilm State Fair or something like that. And you know, I understand that. But yet, we were looking at allowing certain buildings to be named after various companies and so forth. So apparently they're using that as a possible tool here then.
That's one tool that they're using to generate more revenue.
Right.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, I do want to say one thing. I don't think this is a Democrat versus Republican statement because I had the chance to chair back in D.C. a task force which put together a master plan for the Salem waterfront. And we got into a convention center. This town of mine and Jockey's is woefully lacking when it comes to a destination hotel and a conference center as opposed to a convention center. I'm not going to give, there is a distinction there, a major distinction. And if you were from Portland, you would know. Well, I don't want to put him on the spot, but there's a difference between a conference center and a convention center. But anyway, the issue was whether or not we could attract a destination hotel versus a non-destination. That's another whole big discussion. And we need a conference center, a quality conference center in my community. We should have one here. We do not. The question arises, can you do it with just private funds? And there were very conservative business people on that commission with me. And let's be very upfront with you. There were those that were like me. If you want to make me the other extreme, I'll let you do that for purposes of discussion. The fact is that I do not believe you can take this fair and strictly cut it loose and say it's got to go totally on its own. I believe you're going to need, and I'll use the word, some subsidy for this fair to be continued, as you do in a conference center. Anywhere in this country, you do. And I don't think that's an anti-business or a big government or a tax-and-spend type of statement. I think it's a reality. Because, for example, the conference center, if you just let the private sector do it, the room rates for that destination hotel would be so high, you'd have an occupancy problem. Whereas if the city would get involved and do some of the underwriting, the land, et cetera, you can make these things go. And so I want to be sure that at least this is one member of this task force, Mr. Chair. And I haven't, Jack and I sort of talked about this. I don't think we can go totally with to the view, no state dollars, no public dollars, no subsidy. I don't think this task force is going to come down there, and I don't think we can do what we need to do if we take that view. So I just want to start that now with you, since you've been nice enough to ask for our report and good enough to listen to our report, and since you're going to be key players in what happens in the next session of the Oregon Legislature.
Thank you. Other questions?
I have just a little follow-up.
Representative Logan.
Representative Courtney's statement there. How close to being self-supporting has the Oregon State Fair been in the past?
There was a time, I think it was in 93 or 95, where it was pretty much self-supporting. The problem occurred with, when you say self-supporting, does that mean that you're paying your bills, and what about the infrastructure and the buildings? And where the problem is created is you may be able to pay your existing expenses, but you haven't been able to have a reserve in order to pay for the deterioration, and unlike in business, there's no sinking fund out there. So I think probably, I would say from 1993 on, buildings, when we first built them, they were new, and of course they were very functional. Now those buildings have deteriorated. Some of them are scheduled for the Historical Society. I mean, we've got a deterioration problem that as legislators have allowed to just kind of go in. If you're the landlord, which I think we're the landlord, then you're responsible for the upkeep of those buildings.
Just a little follow-up. Sure. So actually, we cannot say that the State Fair has ever been totally self-supporting from the standpoint of capital investment and improvement.
That's correct. Am I correct?
Was there any statutory obligation to be self-supporting?
Jared Wilson, it was the Democrats. We controlled. That said to the State Fair, start charging fees, get as close as you can. But the reason is, and I was here back so many years ago, in the early 80s, if you recall, the state was in a recession, and we had an out-migration goal in the state, and we had, like, we went from the 81 to 83 session. We had four special sessions between 81 and 83 special sessions because we kept going into a deficit because of the downturn in the economy here. And we had to cut. We had to cut like crazy. And we told the state fair. We consciously told them, as we did with OPB and some others, and it all started then, we can't afford you anymore because we're in such a destitute situation. You more and more have to go to. See, when you say the state fair, people think of that event in August and early September. The state fair is an institution that exists 365 days a year, and we told the state fair, you will take that facility during those non-state fair times, as well as during the state fair times, and you'll start cranking up. You will get everything imaginable on those grounds 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and start making enough money that way to pay for the thing. And so we started down that path very, very aggressively trying to do that. The problem was, facilities-wise, I mean, there was a fire out there once that burned down something. Facilities, why? You just take where they show horses out there. Not the racetrack, just where they show horses. I don't know if you've been out there or not. That whole area is ancient, and it's pathetic, and it's lost a major horse show to Redmond. The Morgan Horse Show has left there and gone to Redmond. They had, the armory is another issue you should know about, which is under the National Guard. The site of the girls' 3A basketball championship for years without that armory. We lost that to the child center, regrettably. Now, my community lost it because of that situation. What I'm saying is, over the years, we've just taken the view, you make it pay for itself, state fair, and we cut them loose. And it just didn't work. It just didn't work. That has always been in my district. For your information about the state fair, and I discovered it one day, when I was a city councilman, one of my neighborhood chairs came to me and said, Peter, I think the horse barns, their sewer, is draining directly into one of those open type of gullies you see on the side of the street. I said, that can't be. So we went out there ourselves, picked out the water, scooped up the water, took it over here to the water lab, and the fecal content and the urine content was astronomically high. I went to the state fair, who categorically told me, lied to me, and said, it's not true. We went and got the blueprints in 1934, and sure enough, all the drains and all the horse ponds went directly into an open ditch by the road. I mean, that it went on. And we had to go in immediately with the emergency ball, I'll never forget that day, and have them redo all the plumbing. That's how antiquated some of that structure is out there we've been living with. So when we told them, you make it pay for yourself, it isn't as though we gave them a brand new thing. Now, I don't mean to be critical. I'm just trying to give you a little history of what's going on to that facility out there. The poultry barn, I don't know if you were the poultry barn where the chickens and everything are, it's closed. You went there last fairgrounds, it's all closed. You can't use it. It's so dangerous. Those grandstands for the racetrack area, folks, that's very dangerous stuff out there. That's very, those advanced, dormitory, residence halls, you can't even hardly go in them, just even look around.
I think those dorms were developed somewhere in 1920 or something like that. Mm-hmm. So we're talking about facilities that really are deteriorating, and as landlords, we didn't supply the dollars to make sure that they were maintained and kept up.
Yes, Representative Logan.
With that state of disrepair, does a feasibility study show that it makes sense to repair the present building, or would you have to take them all out and put in a fit new?
Representative Logan, the feasibility study will take it building by building. Those buildings that they will recommend that they're razed. Well, for example, those that you can retain, mm-hmm. They're going through and doing an analysis of all the buildings there.
Mm-hmm. And may I ask one more?
Certainly.
This is getting back again to the relationship between the state fair and the county fairs. Is there competition between the counties and the state and the fairs? I mean, will they really, if they're worried about the success of their own county fair, will they really get behind and support the state fair?
I haven't posed that question, but I would say if you're viewing competition and you're talking elevation of where you have locally a competitive situation that then feeds into a state situation, I think that they would support the state fair, because you're talking about, even if you're talking various sports, you're talking about how you graduate up in a system. And I think that would continue. If you're talking about the competition for everybody wanting to host the state fair, I think that's a totally different question. Yeah.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think the chair is also in a unique position, because Edmund knows he has a relationship with the state fair down there, and he hasn't chosen to talk about it yet, so I don't want to embarrass him. I want to ask, the answer is, I'll give you two answers. There's only competition in that it's like human resource agencies end up starting to fight each other, even though they know they should love each other because the dollars are so few. That we allocate a certain amount of money right now to county fairs out of the state general fund. We do that. And those county fairs need that. And to the extent that they got in competition with the state fair, that's where you'd pit two of them against each other, even though they both admit they need each other and want each other. So there's always that situation. By the way, that's going on in a lot of areas, if you know what I mean, around here. In higher ed fighting with grades K-12, even though they hate it because, you know, there's so much funding. It's that kind of competition. But there isn't the kind of territorial competition, organizational competition. In fact, these county fairs that I know of, and I think I'm going to say this, are totally supportive of the state fair. They want a strong state fair. They need it, and they see themselves in harmony. But when it comes to dollars, if we legislators are in a situation saying, guess what, you folks go off and fight it out among yourselves, there's only so much money we're going to give you all, then you get into Representative Loke, with all due respect, to that kind of fighting that I personally hate to see. So there's where you're going to see the competition, if it comes to that.
Representative Henson.
Well, just a comment on that subsidy of facilities issue. I think every major facility in the Portland area, be it Civic Stadium, the Metro's Convention Center, Expo, which was originally the Pacific Livestock Exposition, and then became the county fairgrounds, and then evolved to Metro as a exhibit building. All of those have had to have public subsidy of the facility in order to survive. And kind of each one has got, you know, you somehow artfully craft some type of a specific arrangement for the specific need of that type of a facility so you can minimize it. And so you can keep the operations dollars usually self-supporting and strong. But the facilities themselves need some type of a subsidy, or they simply can't exist. And if you didn't have some level of public subsidy, then you start missing some significant cultural events that are real important to our communities. I was on the Multnomah County Commission when we finally withdrew all county subsidy to the Multnomah County Fair, and it was a incredibly awkward and ugly decision to have to make, and it took it's when you find out how much support there is for fairs in your community is when you when you start to make that decision. And there's even in a very urban area like Portland, there's a great deal of support.
Well, I want to thank you for your work on this, because it is a very important thing to youngsters down in my community. They really look forward to going to state fair when they've qualified for it. It is like going to the NC2A finals for them. Very exciting. Representative Winter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Courtney and Representative Winters, do either of you know what the attendance has been the last two or three years at the state fair and what the trends are in terms of attendance?
Can I have Janet come up here? The attendance has it's been down from it's on the order of $700,000 a year, but I want to give him because that's one of the things that caused the shortfall this biennium. They thought this last event they'd come up with a certain number, and they went under it. And I want that on the record. It's around 700,000, but I want to show you what's happened. They went. We're going to make a copy of something. Well, this chart, if you go back to 88, it's jumped around. In 1991, we were about 825,000. I'm going back to 1988. That's the highest. Then it went down. 93 was about 775. Then it went down 94, 95, went lower, 96, it went up to about 700, 97. We're going to give you this chart. The 91 was a boom year. Rain's always a factor, but it didn't rain that much this past time. So we'll give you the chart. The attendance, more or less, is at this time, I'm going to say 700,000. It's averaging out.
Always, Representative Witt, when you get the chart, you will also note that it drops and it increases every other year, and that's been kind of consistent. You'll see in 88, it was about 750,000, and in 89, it shot up to 800,000, and then the next year it went down, and that's almost pretty consistent when you look at, except for 95. That was an anomaly year, and I don't know what the variables that happened in 95, but I used to, do a booth at the fair, so we would always know the year that it was going to be down and the one it was going to be up, and for some reason that has been a consistent pattern.
A lot of it has to do, Ms. Chair, I think, with these entertainment events. It's amazing. You bring in entertainment. One year it used to be you pay one price and you get entertainment, and they stopped that. You had to pay two. You get in the fair and you had to pay to see one of these country western things. They fool around with that. They messed around with Senior Day last time around in a way I wish they hadn't. They got rid of Senior Day this last August. They're now admitting that was not a good idea to do that. So there's this some of that's what's going on here from a business perspective. But I'm trying to answer your question as comprehensively as we can, and we'll get you this chart as well.
Yeah, and Mr. Chairman, it seems to me when you have that many Oregonians that are taking the time to go to the state fair and obviously have some interest in it and some enjoyment from it, to ignore it and take the attitude that this is simply, the fair is going to have to deal with this, I think it's kind of a short-sighted way of looking at this. Plus, this is an institution that's been around for how many years? A long, long time. So I think as this work progresses, I think we need to have an open attitude in terms of what can the legislature do with tax dollars to support needs to shore up the state fair. Because there's an awful lot of participation there that Oregonians obviously value the state fair, if you have that level of participation.
I certainly agree with that. On the attendance thing, I think the county fair is really just a miniaturization of what you see in the state fair, and that is we pay so much attention to daily gate attendance at the county fair, and when it's too hot, it affects us. When it rains, it affects us. When you've got the Oak Ridge Boys as headliners, it's a huge night. Doesn't matter what happens. And so a lot of things like that cause it to spike one way or the other. But the baseline attendance is always great, and it's a great galvanizing mechanism for the county, I think. All right, any further questions or comments? Well, thank you again for your work. We appreciate it very much. Thank you. All right, next up, we're going to turn the page to building codes today. Going to hear from the steering committee, update on Senate Bill 587, bill passed in the last legislature. And up is Joe Brewer, Building Codes Division Administrator. Joe, welcome.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Joe Brewer. I'm the administrator at the Building Codes Division. I'd like to thank the committee for taking its time to hear our report today, and I'd like to thank all of you for your interest in our issues, in particular Chairman Wilson, for the time he spent working with us on a number of bills last session and the follow-up on their implementation during the interim. What I'm going to be doing today is providing you with an update on our steering committee activity. That's a group that's euphemistically called the Greenfield Group, assembled by Director Mike Greenfield as a result of some issues that arose last session, and I'll go into those in a few minutes. I'm going to give you an update on Senate Bill 587. That's a bill that, for the first time, puts some timelines in place, provides some predictability for a number of issues, like plan review for residential construction, appeals with respect to technical issues dealt with on construction sites. Then we're going to talk a little bit about the implementation of Senate Bill 512. That bill created the Metro Service Center and hopefully puts in place some mechanisms to streamline, make easier for the development community a number of issues in the Tri-County area. Chair Lisa Nato will be joining me later on in the presentation to provide an update on some of our activities. Also joining me later on will be Joan Steven Schwinger. We owe a debt of gratitude and thanks to the Bureau of Labor and Industries and Commissioner Roberts for sending us his best and brightest to help us implement this bill and to get the service center up and operational. Last session, I'm sure I'm preaching to the choir, but last session we had a fairly contentious process that took place around the building code's budget. A proposed fee increase for the first time in 25 years, building codes was proposing to raise its structural permitting fees. There was also a proposal to increase our surcharge. And in general, with the issues I just spoke to regarding Senate bills and our budget specifically, there was a lot of discussion, debate around the relative benefit of a statewide building code, the need for particular fee increases, in particular the surcharge, the appropriateness of subsidizing inspection activities in across the state by the division with surcharges collected on building permits from all around the state. So because of that, the director, Mike Greenfield, at that time decided to put in place a steering committee to review with building codes what we do, how we do it. Our system had been in place for 25 years. Over that time, a great deal of unresolved conflict had been folded into our statutes and had really made the division in many respects the soft material between the two factions on both sides, the regulators and the development community, putting the division in sometimes in an untenable position. So the first step was to have a series of meetings around the state and gather feedback. Several issues emerged consistently as we traveled around the states. In many respects, I feel as though those meetings were a vote of confidence for the statewide building code, for the need for a consistent construction standard in our state, and for the division itself. Some of the changes that we've made and some of the efforts that are underway to try and improve our customer service. The meetings were well attended by industry. Chair Wilson attended the meeting in Grants Pass. Representative Butler attended the meeting in Ontario, spoke eloquently of our political process and the process we use for regulating construction in our state. What emerged was a clear picture of some dynamic tension between the issues of local control, the need for local service delivery, and the need for consistency in code administration throughout our state. In particular, comes to my mind the meeting in Pendleton. There was a county official, I believe it was from Morrow County, who after hearing a number of folks speak in the room, when it was his turn, he stood up and he said that I came here intending to propose that we provide more local control to governments, county governments in our state around these issues. And after hearing the discussion in the room by the development community, I've been moved to a position where I understand that what we really need is more consistency in how this standard is implemented, how this standard is administered. So that those meetings around the state were really a learning exercise for myself, for all the staff that attended, for Director Greenfield. I think they were very beneficial. Some of the issues that came up consistently as we traveled around the state, the number one issue for industry was compliance. The need for, in fact, the demand for a level playing field, the demand that the division, that the jurisdictions deal with the bad actors in our state, deal with those individuals who were knowingly operating outside the requirements of our statutes and our rules. And as a result of that, we came back after having identified that as our number one issue for the industry and asked staff to give that some attention. And our two compliance officers got together and put a proposal on the table that will really significantly change the way we do compliance in our state. Their proposal is simple, and it's amazing when you turn to the folks that have the frontline knowledge and ask them what you should do, the ideas they come up with. They very simply want us to invest in the inspector in the field the authority to cite these violators. And then if that violator fails to request a hearing within a given timeline, that individual's fined. In the past, we have erred too greatly on the side of due process, trying to give those violators every opportunity to access the system, every opportunity to request hearings, to the extent that in some cases I think we may have dismissed cases that should not have been dismissed. So this process is currently being reviewed by the steering committee. We'll have a meeting on the 31st, I believe it is, of March, spend the full day working on this compliance proposal, getting feedback from the steering committee. We presented it to a number of organizations around the state already, gotten some very insightful input. I think there are some 15 items that folks have recommended that we fold into this process. We've approached building departments, jurisdictions in the Central Oregon area, Bend, Deschutes County, Prineville, asking them to pilot this activity for us for a period of time so we can learn from this and make sure that the changes we're making make good sense. They've agreed to do that. And the good news is most of the changes, if not all, that would be required of this change are administrative in nature, and we already have the authority to do that. The second most consistent issue, as we spoke to folks around the state, was consistency in code and administration. This nut won't be as easy to crack because we've got 125, 30-odd jurisdictions in the state and innumerable inspectors and plan reviewers involved in the process. But again, both the jurisdictions and industry have reinforced the expectation that we focus on consistent code administration and really make that one of the primary issues in administering the code. Again, that puts us in that dynamic tension that I referenced earlier between local control and the consistent administration of a statewide policy. And that's a balancing act that, frankly, we're going to have to pursue vigorously. The third issue that came up, again, around the state as we spoke to folks was program assumption. Our current process in Oregon allows any jurisdiction to assume a building inspection program or any piece thereof simply by writing a letter to the jurisdiction, writing a letter to the state and committing to hiring certified inspectors. This has resulted in a patchwork quilt of building programs around the state that range from the full nine yards, the full service, to maybe only doing structural mechanical, maybe only doing the plumbing piece or the electrical piece, picking off those elements of the program that are most profitable. As a result, customers are confused. They're not sure where to go to comply. They're not sure if they've obtained all the permits they require. And I think in many cases, this has resulted in a situation where people simply throw their hands up and walk away from the system, saying, I'd love to do what's expected, but I just can't figure this out. So that's something, again, that I hope we can address in this interim steering committee process. Qualifications for licensing and certification came up consistently around the state again. Another instance where divergent opinions, everything from our standards are too high to our standards are too low, came up consistently. My memory goes to a meeting we had in Eugene where I think we had three apprentice classes that were supposed to be meeting in a facility down there that night show up at our meeting in Eugene and simply make a plea that we not do anything to lessen the requirements for licensing in our state because of the high standard that had been put in place for licensing trades, both electrical and plumbing. Again, a very active meeting, a lot of good feedback. All of this was captured. We tried to diligently record each and every comment that was made. In recording those comments, we looked for the consistent items. We sent those comments back out to everyone that attended the meeting and invited all of them to volunteer for subcommittee activities related to the steering committee. Another issue that came up consistently is the subject of Senate Bill 587. Is the advent of third-party inspection services and plan review services around our state. What was the appropriate role for them to play? What was the expectation in terms of dealing with them along with or in lieu of jurisdictions? Permitting and plan review processes came up. Again, the issue being lack of consistency with the number of jurisdictions and the patchwork quilt of programs around our state. Does one jurisdiction administer the program, same requirements for information submittal, so forth and so on, as another? We found that the industry as a whole is very confused and very upset with the fact that it's different everywhere they go. Incentive programs for complying contractors came up consistently. We'll be reporting to the next legislature on a program here in Marion County called the Master Builder Program. Marion County and the City of Salem are pilot areas for that program. This is a process whereby general contractors attend training on codes and on administrative requirements, pass tests to demonstrate that they've accumulated this knowledge. And as a result of that, the local building official can put those individuals on their master builder list, and then those builders are given dispensation from certain inspections in the process. So this is a key incentive for them to get away from what in some cases are burdensome requirements. Related to the steering committee activity and the subject of other legislation that passed last session was Senate Bill 803 and the boards and that the division deals with. The division deals with, I think at this time, six boards with the inclusion of the Metro Service Center Board. We have the Plumbing Electrical Board, the Elevator Electrical Board, Plumbing Board, Boiler Board, Structural Board, Manufacturer Structures Board. Senate Bill 803 requires us to take a look at that and see if there are any benefits in folding these boards together. Consistently, we heard when we went around the state concern that perhaps labor industry has too much influence over these boards' activities, that the codes that are adopted are too complex, that we amend the codes too extensively, that perhaps we should entertain simply adopting national codes. Our division, the industry, when I say the industry in this case, I mean building inspection programs around the states, use of technology came up consistently. Why can't we be on similar systems? Why can't we use some of the technology that's been developed to perhaps streamline and shorten some of the timelines that builders have to deal with? Another issue that came up in many cases was the role of the Building Codes Division versus the role of the Construction Contractors Board. Where do we go to comply? How do these processes and these roles overlap? So those are the consistent issues that we took to the steering committee. They agreed that these were, in fact, the consistent themes that have come up, and we're intending to hold a meeting dedicated to each of these and try and get the steering committee to focus on what would the ideal system look like. Forget what's taken place in the past. Share a few war stories if you have to. Forget that. Forget that we've perhaps mistreated each other and haven't been as willing to work together as we could in the past. But how would it look like if we were in that place in the future? And I think with their help, we're going to get there. And my hope is that we can come out of that process with some concrete proposals. The current plan is to, this volunteer task group, and I believe we've passed out a list of participants, is very hands-on. Our intent in the beginning was to ask the steering committee to simply commission a number of task groups to work on these specific issues, but the steering committee said, no, we're much more interested, we're much more committed than that. We want to touch each of these issues ourselves. We want to work with these hands-on and actually craft the proposals that come out of this group ourselves. So the current plan, again, is to work through the issues listed above. Through next August, in preparation for our next report to this committee in September. Our hope is that we'll have some very well thought out concrete proposals to make on how we can improve our system and prepare to make it effective over the next 25 years. And I hope at that time, again, we'll have our proposed changes in rules and statutes to share with you. I'd be happy to take any questions the committee might have on our steering committee activity, where we're at in that process, and where we're going.
Thank you. Committee, any questions relating to 587 here before we move to 512? All right. Seeing none, let's turn the page. Joe, thank you.
Bearing the chair's indulgence, that was the steering committee activity. We're going to move on, I think, to 587. One of the things that I'd like to share with the committee is a great deal of legislation was passed last session related to building codes. It's keeping our division very busy. We have 17 advisory committees currently underway, giving us feedback on how we might change this system. So a personal thought is that, I wouldn't have hurt feelings if we didn't pass any legislation on building codes next session, but I'm sure there will be some things come forward. Senate Bill 587. This bill started out as an attempt to privatize or open the arena of building inspection and plan review to open private sector competition. Now, this bill had been proposed by Senator Byers a number of sessions in a row, had not really received the attention that perhaps it should, but last session seemed to be ripe, and there was a lot of work put into Senate Bill 587. And thanks to willingness of all parties to compromise, in fact, we came out with a bill, I think, that makes some very significant changes in what we do to regulate construction in our state. It does not privatize or open to a competition the entire arena. It does establish some timelines. It does allow for the licensing of third-party providers, and it requires jurisdictions to share that with applicants when they come in if the building department can't meet a specific timeline. So the division's charged again with drafting rules on this legislation. The timeline for plan review of residential construction is 10 days, according to the bill, for jurisdictions less than 300,000, 15 days for jurisdictions greater than 300,000. A great deal of work has gone already into these draft rules. A definition of simple residential construction, for instance, that seems like a simple thing to address, but when you sit down and talk about how should this be defined, it becomes a little more problematic. The advisory committee on this effort has proposed rules that would define simple as any residential construction less than 4,500 square feet that follows the prescriptive path in the 1 and 2 family dwelling code, which is actually a fairly broad definition. And I think we'll give the jurisdictions a real tool to work with in terms of speeding the plan review process and not necessarily requiring engineering on residences that may have been built in other jurisdictions that are very similar or the same to the plans that are being submitted to this particular jurisdiction. The bill also requires timelines for commercial plan review. Those timelines would be proposed to the division in the jurisdiction's operating plan. Each jurisdiction's required, as a result of legislation passed in 1995, to submit to the division an operating plan that touches on specific elements of building department administration. These plans are not approved by the division. They're simply received by the division and checked to ensure that they cover all the elements that are required. Those operating plans, the intent behind them is to craft the service delivery elements at the local level. So one size does not fit all. Construction and demands by the development industry are very much different in Lake Oswego than they are in Grants Pass. So the intent was to allow for those issues to be dealt with at the local level and then to have them simply on file at the state. Draft rules produced by the task group on Senate Bill 587 would require jurisdictions to notify applicants within 3 days of the application if their application was complete and if the timeline required by the bill could be met. If the timeline cannot be met, then the jurisdiction would provide that applicant with the names of three licensed providers, and then it would be that applicant's choice to either go out to one of those private sector providers or to wait in line and get that plan review done by the jurisdiction. So this is for the first time now we have some predictability in the process for builders. We're very optimistic about this. Consistently, again, we heard the problem is we just don't know. We send our stuff in, we might not hear, and when we do hear, well, they need more information. So what I call that with my staff is we're not going to play the guess again game. We're going to tell our customers up front what's required. We're going to check it as soon as it comes in and let them know if additional information is required. We're going to see the implementation of these timelines statewide. This bill also implements the chief inspector concept in all specialty code areas. The plumbing industry, the electrical industry, for some time has enjoyed the benefit of a chief inspector, someone who is the preeminent authority in the state on that code. And when a disagreement occurs at the local level, you appeal to the building official in that jurisdiction. Perhaps you still disagree. In the past, in many areas, your only choice was to get in line and wait for the appeal to go to the board. This could take months. The chief inspector concept allows for an individual to take that appeal to the chief inspector if they wish, again, at the customer's discretion, and get the state's perspective on that particular code issue in relatively short order. So hopefully this will resolve a number of those conflicts and speed, again, development across our state. The bill, again, calls for licensing the third-party plan review and inspection providers. It restricts those providers from providing both those services. It was felt by some at the table that it was potentially problematic to have a private sector firm do both the review of the plans and the inspection itself. So there is a prohibition in the bill against both of those. The bill also addressed a very significant issue for local jurisdictions, and that was or is the commingling of building department funds. We had an advice letter from the Attorney General's office saying that legislation from prior sessions had precluded jurisdictions from commingling funds. So they would be under the same requirement as the state. You can't mix electrical funds with plumbing funds, with manufactured housing funds, and that was going to be a real problem for many jurisdictions. This bill allows them to commingle those funds, except for electrical funds, and use them to support the building department only. So we do see dedication in this bill of building department funds, but it allows, again, for some commingling. All the provisions of this bill go in, and again, that all of the above were negotiations that went on between many factions in the industry. In particular, I'd like to mention the League of Oregon Cities and the Oregon Building Officials Association. Initially, this was a very hard bill for them to support through efforts by all the folks at the table. Through their efforts, some agreement was reached, and we came up with a bill that made some very significant changes. All these provisions go into effect July 1st. An advisory task group with representatives from the jurisdiction, the industry, the division, have been assembled, and draft rules on all these issues are being addressed right now, and I think we have some folks who will make some comments about them after you've asked whatever questions you might have about this bill.
Thanks. Questions relating to 587, Representative Winters.
I have one question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So why was the electrical exempt?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Winters, for some time now, I believe since time began, electrical funds have always been dedicated specifically to electrical inspection activities. And that's, I believe, because of the industry's strong support for licensing requirements and their acknowledgement that even though perhaps licensing fees subsidize some of these other areas, it's important to have a strong electrical inspection programs, electrical licensing program in our state.
Any more?
Well, I mean, interesting since everyone else is allowed to commingle, and I would assume that everyone's position is that their program also is very valid and very needed and very necessary, and that we would want high standards no matter whether we're talking about electrical or whether we're talking manufactured homes, whatever the area in building that we were talking about, that we'd want to assure that there were good inspections. Is that not true?
Again, Mr. Chairman, Representative Winters, certainly that's true from my perspective, and everyone I've spoken to espouses those same beliefs. My only conclusion can be the electrical industry got there first. They got there early on, and they required dedication of these funds from the very beginning.
Representative Hansen.
One element that may have affected this, too, is that Glenn Otto was an electrician and not a plumber.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen can say that. I can't.
All right. Any other questions about 587 here? Anybody in the audience want to make any comment on 587? We kind of need to move along here and get to 512 if we can. We've got some people that need to hit the road here as close to 315 as possible.
Mr. Chairman, I believe we do have one else is here.
All right, very good. Then let's go to 512, Jeff.
Quickly, a brief history of the legislation, then I'll turn it over to... I'll turn it over to Chair Nato. Quickly, in 1973, the legislature decided that it was a good idea to have a statewide building code. That served us for a long period of time, got us to 1997, when the industry stakeholders were concerned about uniformity of code administration, particularly in the Tri-County area. So House Bill 3290 was passed in that session, requiring a task force, creating a task force to address this issue. Task force came together. There was not complete consensus, but there was a product that came out of that task group, Senate Bill 512. Again, compromises were made by all parties, and a bill was passed that put in place the Metro Service Center and the Metro Service Metro Tri-County Building Industry Service Board, again, with the goal of creating uniform administration of building codes for programs in Clackamas, Multnomah, and Washington counties. With that, I'd like to turn it over to Chair Nato and Joan Stevens-Schwinger to talk about some of the accomplishments of the Senate Bill 512 Tri-County Board and the progress we've made so far. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Joe. Welcome.
Thank you. Chair Wilson and members of the committee, thank you very much. I am the chair of the Tri-County Service Board, the board set up by 512. I had the unfortunate occurrence of missing the first meeting and therefore was elected chair. Probably added to that the fact that I know the least amount about the subject matter at hand, but I do know how to run a meeting. So we have a 13-member board. It's been appointed by the governor. Our first meeting was December 16th. It's a fairly rigorous timeline that we were under because you had directed that the proposed rules be adopted in a very timely fashion. We have representatives of industry, local government, elected officials, architects, and building officials. And I have to report, it's been an exemplary working relationship, and it's really been a wonderful board to serve with. We will be able to deliver the mandated services on time. We have wonderful cooperation of people in the industry and building officials in the 27 affected jurisdictions that we're working with. Subcommittees completed their work on the proposed administrative rules, and the board approved them, I think it was last week. They are scheduled for public hearing April 18th. The forms subcommittee has agreed to continue meeting until it finishes work on forms and processes, and Clint Hillman is here to speak a little more about that. The minor label program will be launched from the Tri-County Service Center beginning July 1, and we have finalized a service center lease, and we're taking steps to furnish and customize the office with computer systems. We'll be located at the east end of the Burnside Bridge in Portland, 123 Northeast Cooch, Suite 400. Just a brief update of the proposed administrative rules that we approved. The minor label subcommittee has completed we've completed and adopted the proposed rules. They're drafted fairly broadly to allow the board to update the actual procedures. They will cover minor label programs in electrical and plumbing, and we will convene again later this year to begin work on a minor label program for structural and mechanical installations and perhaps some commercial installations. The cost of a minor label sheet, right now the people doing the work have to carry around up to like 27 times, I think even three, different forms for all the different jurisdictions. And this will give them one form that will be issued out of the service center that they will purchase, and then those will be randomly inspected, and the inspection fee will go to the local government that performs the inspection. The Forms and Process Subcommittee, again, the rules are crafted broadly. It's been a very cohesive group, and Clint Hillman will speak a bit more about that. The final subcommittee is on fee methodology, and those rules are drafted rather narrowly to outline the methodology for the different permits, and they have completed their work, but we'll continue working on a few other issues after the summer. I just want to say I've been very pleased. I think we're basically cutting a lot of red tape, and it'll be just convenient. I'm a promoter of affordable housing, and I think it'll help build the cost down. It'll provide we're working towards greater certainty for those who perform the work and the installation, so they know what is expected and required, and ultimately that will be the goal, that we'll have some kind of uniformity in our area. With that, I'll turn it over to Clint to speak briefly about the forms and process of the subcommittee.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Wilson and members of the committee. The forms process subcommittee has one of the larger tasks, because as you can understand, when you start to take the different jurisdictions with their different structures and within the cities and make some commonality, there's a lot of changes that have to be made. And we started meeting during the 3290 task force and working on some of these issues so that we were prepared, more prepared to move ahead. And I have to echo what Lisa has said about the working with industry and the local jurisdictions. I can report that on our subcommittee, and we've met several times and hammered out a lot of proposed rules and worked on some forms, and we've had some spirited debates and some lively discussions, but every vote has been unanimous, and that's with a mix of industry and local representatives on the committee. So I think that's good. And I also mentioned that what's been very helpful for us to move along this quickly is the support by BCD staff. Mark Long and Joni Steven Schwinger and BCD staff has worked very hard. As Joe mentioned, there's a lot of committees going on right now, and sometimes they would promise something at a committee, and the next morning we'd have it, which meant that there's overtime, extra effort being put in by a very dedicated staff at Building Codes Division. And with that kind of support, it made us able to get these rules and draft rules in a short time. Also on the Forms Process Committee, we have draft forms that are now out for everyone to take a look at and get comments back within a couple of weeks, and we'll be moving permit application forms, a common standard form. We'll be moving that to the committee very soon. So we've had a lot of activity. There's a subcommittee or a task force that's assisting the subcommittee in coming up with the forms and the difficult task of the processes and bringing commonality there. So in the future, we're going to continue to work on these, tackle the more difficult issues. Some of the process issues become more long-term. I'll give you one example. If a small jurisdiction has been using a process where they require a complete submittal, and they don't break it up into pieces, but they can take the complete plan and review it and put it out the door, they can do that with less staff than it will take to do a phased process where you come in, you bring a partial plan in, you review that, you do a foundation plan, and then when a shell of the building comes in, you have to go back, look at the foundation, and pull the pieces together. In some cases, it could require, if everyone's going to do a phased process, it could require some staffing additions, some staffing changes, which have to go through city councils and budget committees. So some of these can be long term. I do feel that in the long term, as we work toward these, we'll get there. Some of them won't be immediate quick fixes. Some of them will take a little longer. I would want to echo a feeling that Joe expressed earlier. We had a lot of legislation passed this last year, and we're working hard, and some of these are going to take long term. So I would hope that the legislature is, and this committee is sensitive to too many changes coming in this next year other than ones that would really be necessary.
Thank you.
Next, I would like to introduce staff Joni Steven Schwinger. I have to echo what Clint said about staff. When I looked at this, and it was in January at that time, and looked at our timeline, I really expected to be before you telling you that we would need more time. And the fact that we've had hard-working subcommittees and wonderful staff has contributed to the ability to meet your your guidelines. So with that, Joni?
Chairman Wilson, members of the committee, I'm, for the record, I'm Joan Stephen-Schwanger. I'm the manager of the Tri-County Service Center. And as Lisa said, we're starting up. We should open about the 15th of June, we hope. We're a little bit ahead of schedule. And that will be on the east side of the Burnside Bridge, right in the center of town. Should be easy for folks to get to. But they won't have to come there necessarily to get our services. And I think that that's probably one of the most important features of our service center. As everyone has said here before, the order of the day is consistency and efficiency, I think. We're really trying to make the lives of building officials and of our contractors a lot easier. And I think that a lot of the work that has been accomplished here in the subcommittee so far has made that happen. And just to kind of go over that point, I wanted to point out to you a little bit about the minor label program. And this little handout probably, I mean, you do have copies of the administrative rules, which I'm sure in your quiet moments you'll want to read. But I think this will outline for you kind of what the problems were. We had a very bulky system where you had a lot of folks, where you had contractors that they wanted to go out and do a job, and they were working in the Tri-County area. They had to deal with 27 jurisdictions in order to get labels, and these are labels for minor installations of plumbing and electrical. And so they would have to go there. They would have to buy sheets of 10. You can only buy them in lots of 10. And after the year is up, and that's how long the time frame is, they may have only done 3 installations in Happy Valley and 2 out in Gresham and a whole mess of them in Multnomah County. But those sheets, they can't get any money back for them. It's kind of their loss, and which, they, of course, they pass on to the consumer. And it wasn't working for them. So first they had to deal with 27 different jurisdictions. And then when they went out to do their installation, they had to make sure that they were affixing the right jurisdiction's label in the area. So they had to go out with a Thomas guide and whatever kind of surveying equipment they needed to find out where they were and to be there at the right time. Then they could perform the work. And then after that, they sent the stuff into the building officials. Well, this was a very cumbersome process, obviously, and people were very unhappy. And I'll say that working on the committee, we had industry folks who really helped us streamline the whole process. Building officials really helped us here as well. And as you can see in the streamlined program, you buy the labels in one spot. You can use the contractor just uses that sheet of labels, sends them into the service center. We randomly select one of the installations for inspection, and that's that. It's a lot easier. We reimburse the building departments for the inspection. And so rather than having all of that energy really focused on the contract, we're able to streamline that for the contractor, and actually I think it's streamlined for the building officials as well. So it looks like it's going to be a good process, and that is really going to be the focus of the administration at the service center. We'll be recording the data, arranging with the building jurisdictions for those inspections, and really taking care of that minor label program. At the same time, we'll be functioning as a clearinghouse for information. We have several other things on the docket from the bill. Right now, we have a task force where we've asked for a committee to come together to advise us on reviewing the qualifications of folks who are applying for licensing and certification as inspectors. And also another item we have is to develop and make available appropriate training for inspectors and plans reviewers. And we're looking into that in the next month. We need to have something online probably around the first of the year on those two items. And for later consideration, and this echoes all the other bills, we need to establish sufficient resources to help local officials interpret building codes, establish a process to facilitate consistent application of codes, and develop a process to resolve disputes between building codes of building officials and contractors and developers. So we have a lot in the docket, and we're hoping that we can act as a clearinghouse for information, that we can put together a really dynamite website for folks to use. We're hoping that we're going to be able to get our forms, the forms that Clint is talking about, on the internet in an interactive format so that contractors can use them, they can calculate their permit fees, and their lives will be a lot easier. So,
again, I would just also like to thank Mark Long for all of this work. Mm-hmm. Are there any questions of the committee?
Okay. I do.
questions. Representative Winters.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, and either one of you can respond. With all this efficiency, because this is really very nice to see that you're talking one stop and not having to go to 27 jurisdictions, and you're talking about forms and a whole host of efficiency steps. Has anybody done any projection of how much you're going to save?
Yeah, what about that, you? The savings, this is a good question, because who would the savings be from? I think the savings in this case would be some of the red tape that the building officials, the building permit areas have to deal with right now. We'll probably be saving them some money in terms of recording data and taking care of any of those processes that are surrounding the minor label. As far as contractors are concerned, I think we've made it much easier for business to conduct business and not have to deal with a lot of jurisdictional considerations. They can just do a straightforward permit and know that that's taken care of. And so I think the savings is really in the pocket of the consumer who has faster services.
Mm-hmm. Follow. Lisa had mentioned the one of her passions, if you will, is affordable housing, and that this would probably help to, particularly in the metropolitan Portland area, to kind of speed up that or where you have more of an incentive. And I think anytime we look at incentive, we're looking at the ability to lower the cost someplace that will allow more to occur. And I think that was probably the point that you were making, wasn't it, Lisa?
Exactly, Mr. Chair and Representative Winters. Where there can be predictability and a faster timeline, that kind of timeline is very expensive for the developers, not knowing the standards that will be applied, or maybe they filed the wrong form, or how do they calculate the actual fee in their upfront estimate that they're giving. All of that are factors that go into the cost ultimately, and if we can reduce all of those factors or some of them for any project, for some projects it will be a significant difference.
Further questions? Well, I'd like to thank you for your work. It was a very interesting bill to work on. I found it really fascinating, especially as a freshman working with that bill in my committee, and enjoyed working with everyone. Amidst the cries of some of increasing bureaucracy, it looked to me to be a really great opportunity to make things better for those in the trades and those in the industry in general. So, again, thank you. Great to see it come together.
I do understand that Kevin Wing from the Home Builders is here and maybe wanted to speak, and I would just echo your comments. And I think it's very forward-thinking legislation. I almost think we had to have legislation to sort of force everyone to the table mm-hmm. and get this done. But I think it's so far been an extreme success story.
Sure, great. And remind us about too many bills next time. Thank you very much.
You're
I
welcome.
Appreciate that. Representative Hansen.
Just thank you thank you for all the hard work you're doing on it. This is real exciting to watch it come to life.
Yes, it has. And thank you, dear. Yeah. Representative Hansen.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. Kevin Wing, representing the Home Builders Association of Metropolitan Portland. I won't take much of your time because everything I would have to say would be positive. I want to echo the comments that have been made about the work that the Oregon Building Officials Association has done and the BCD staff has done has been extraordinary. And maybe give you a little background about me. When I was a junior across the street here at the best university in the state of Oregon, I took a part-time job with a home builder, and I was a political science major, and I was sort of wondering why a home builder would hire a political science major to handle his building permit responsibilities. And I soon found out why. And in the 10 years that I've been in the industry, both as working for a builder and now as a lobbyist for the Portland home builders, I think I've applied for building permits in over 82 jurisdictions. So I have a unique sort of perspective on all the red tape that's out there. And I've never seen anything this productive in such a short time in terms of cutting red tape and making it easier for my members to get through the process. And it's been very pleasing to sit down with building officials. We often have an adversarial relationship, and I haven't always understood that, but I'm sure there are many reasons for it. It's been very pleasing to sit down with them and realize that we have similar concerns. And the solutions that we have come up with have been fairly unanimous. And, you know, I think when this bill was being debated in the legislature, a lot of the building officials were afraid that it would cause them pain. And I hope they have found that that's not the case, because we have worked with them very well, I think, and they have worked with us very well. And we're finding common solutions to common problems. And with that, let me just close and say that industry is very happy with what's going on here, and thank you for the work that you did in giving us this system.
Great. Thank you. Representative Logan.
Question, not particularly of Mr. Name.
Kevin Wayne.
Kevin.
Yeah.
But just generally, I have a contractor son, small contractor, and does lots of remodeling. And I can hardly wait to tell him that this is going forward, because I've heard a number of the problems he has faced in getting permits and waiting for permits, and that really means dollars out of the pocket of the contractor. Mm-hmm. So, but I'd like to know the address of this new service center so I can give it to my son. And I don't think it was
231 Northeast Cooch.
123 Southeast Cooch.
Northeast Cooch.
Northeast Cooch.
Mm-hmm. Will there be any special event that day marking the opening?
No, but that sounds like a good idea.
Well, I'd almost be willing to jump on my two-wheel conveyance and come up and be a part of it.
Mr. Chairman,
like a deal.
May I have a quick addendum, please?
Yes.
Our association did a series of forums around the metro area to advertise this, and we had Jim Chapman, who is on the board, speak to a number of our members throughout the area, and I was amazed at the number of jaws that were dropping about some of the things that we were doing. And, you know, early on, these have been fairly simple tasks, I think, but you would be amazed at how important they are seen in the eyes of the guys who are out there, guys and gals who are out there building homes.
Yeah, certainly. Any further?
Nothing, just a comment, Mr. Chair. I'm glad that it's been received with open arms and with the level of cooperation that everyone's expressing, and I would hope that these deliberations continue, because the other issue is the consistency issue that keeps coming up and has been for years and years, that if we can get that kind of unanimity and support, I think we would be just well way ahead in Oregon in our vote.
Thank you, Representative. All right, thank you very much. Appreciate that. Anyone else wishing to speak on this? If not, we've exhausted our agenda today, and we are adjourned.